What Yunshi and I plan to do is make this course pretty much a survey of quantum phases of matter. The goal will be to kind of cover this very big field from two different perspectives. I will basically present several toy lattice models which make the essential physics very clear. And Yin Shen will cover basically the field theory aspects of these phases of matter. And so roughly we'll go in kind of like a alternating basis in which you'll get to see both the discrete lattice, explicit calculations, and you also get to see the field theory description of these lattice models and these phases of matter. Okay, and yeah, so the goal will be to introduce the essential physics of many quantum phases of matter of recent interest, including topological phases of matter, for example. Okay, so let's maybe start out with some motivation for why should we care about phases of matter. So I think probably one of the biggest and probably pretty obvious motivation is that with phases of matter, you can get this phenomenon of emergence, right? Where say you have like say you know the laws of some individual degree of freedom very well, like a spin or an electron. So for example, you've studied hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics, but the whole idea behind quantum phases of matter is that when you put many of these degrees of freedom together, you can actually get very different phenomena from the individual constituents. So the fact that you have many degrees of freedom and they're all interacting in some way can give rise to what people sometimes call emergent phenomena. That's not possible with just a few degrees of freedom. You really need a macroscopic number that are highly correlated in some way. So emergence is one very interesting aspect, and we'll see plenty of examples of this. One other motivation is that this could actually be pretty practical. Okay. And I know at PI we don't often use the word practical, but there actually is a practical side to this. So for example, as you all probably know, your phones have these semiconductors. Semiconductors already, are pretty much phases of matter, right? They do involve collective degrees of freedom of many electrons in a crystal, right? So that's already one, obviously practical example. But semiconductors are actually, relative to the topics we'll discuss, are somewhat more mundane phases of matter, right? So they're quantum mechanics is important in describing them, but actually not that important, as we'll see, right? So some of these phases that we'll cover actually have even more ambitious practical applications, more speculative applications. So for example, some of the phases we will discuss might be useful for new platforms to build quantum computers. Okay. And one other conceptual motivation for caring about phases of matter is a notion of universality. Obviously there are tons of materials out there in the real world, and we at least, I think many theorists don't want to enumerate every different material and see what goes on this material, what goes on this material, et cetera. And so instead, it's useful to talk about a phase of matter as an equivalence class of many materials, right? You can say if this set of materials all have fundamentally the same properties, and we'll define that more precisely soon, then we'll say that's all in one phase of matter. We don't have to enumerate all of them. It's a much more compressed and elegant description of a certain pattern of correlations as opposed to specific details. Okay. So, to emphasize this point, we'll be seeing a bunch of phase diagrams in this course. So imagine you have some different parameters of your system, maybe P1, P2, right? Then, depending on where you are in this parameter space, your system might exhibit different phenomena, and you might have different phases, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. And again, we don't want to enumerate all possible different parameter values, right? That would be too much information. We just care about the qualitative universal behavior of a phase. So we can say two different points might belong to the same phase if they have the same long distance properties. And the benefit of looking at phases this way is that often there's some representative point. There's some representative point in each phase that other representatives of the phase can be related to. And these representative points often have much simpler, cleaner behavior to analyze. Okay. So this is one other motivation for the whole definition of the phase of matter. Okay, so indeed, we'll see that lattice models will have one advantage of being able to see properties explicitly, and field theory description will help us understand what's universal in the lattice model. And field theories will be particularly useful when describing phase transitions between different phases. Say what happens at these boundaries. So that's why this whole lattice field theory dichotomy is, I think, a very useful way to organize the survey. Okay, so I think the notion of phase diagram is already familiar to many of you, just from even from classical statistical mechanics, right? So even without talking about any quantum phenomena, of course, with classical SEMEC, we have a notion of different phases that are tuned by temperature, right? So you might have a system that undergoes some finite temperature transition from solid to gas, let's say. And these are driven by thermal fluctuations, by just raising the temperature in your system, right? But with quantum phases of matter, it turns out that even at zero temperature, we can have already different phases and transitions between them by tuning not temperature, but some parameter that quantifies the interactions in your system. Okay. So this is usually classical. But now, even along the zero temperature axis, we can have quantum phases and transitions. Okay. So so one important question is basically how quantum are these phases? How non-classical are these phases and their transitions? Are they really that different from these finite temperature transitions, for example? And so one way of addressing this question will be to quantify how quantum they are by using entanglement. Okay, so yeah, that's just a lightning overview with some motivation for is it matter, why we should care about them. Okay, so now I will present some somewhat boring but necessary formalism, just setting the stage for lattice models. Okay. Yeah, I should also have said that you can, feel free to interrupt anytime with questions. Okay. All right. So let's first talk about what is a lattice model. So first thing we need to do when specifying a lattice model is to first specify what Hilbert space we're talking about. So imagine we have some lattice of sites. Where each point represents some finite dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, and let's say we have n sites. So I've drawn this in one dimension just for concreteness. Yeah, so we have this finite dimensional Hilbert space on every site, and again, for concreteness, let's just take this to be a two-level system, okay. Like a spin, or you can call it a qubit. Okay, and in this spin 1/2 or qubit Hilbert space, we have operators, these Pauli spin operators. And usually we'll just work in a convention which we work in the computational basis for sigma z. Okay. That'll be the typically what convention we'll choose. So we have sigma z eigenstates. Okay, so the total Hilbert space, of course, is just a tensor product of these individual Hilbert spaces. And so this will have a very large dimension for the case of this spin 1/2 lattice. Okay, so that's Hilbert space, nothing fancy. And the next step is to define some Hamiltonian. And Hamiltonian is very important. It basically just specifies how these degrees of freedom talk to each other, like what are their interactions. So in general, a Hamiltonian, in its most general form, is just a sum of Hermitian operators, right? This is the most general form. And each Hermitian operator here, in general, acts on this entire T to the n dimensional Hilbert space. It's a very large object. Okay? However, that's too general for many physical contexts. And indeed, like a very, very important aspect of the Hamiltonians we'll consider is a notion of locality. So locality is a very important property of Hamiltonians, which we will assume, and which most physical systems in nature obey, right? So by locality, what I mean is that these HI terms in the Hamiltonian will no longer be completely general operators, but instead they will describe interactions that only involve a few spins, a few qubits, and I'll further assume that these interactions only couple spins that are close to each other. Okay, so basically these terms in the Hamiltonian will not be general 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices, but instead they'll be mostly identity on the majority of the spins, but they'll be non-trivial only, say, for a couple neighboring spins. So there might be some non-trivial Pauli matrix acting on spins at I and I plus 1, for example. Okay, but everything else will be identity. Yeah, okay, so this is what I'll refer to as a local operator. So here I'll just mean actually spatially local. It acts on I and I plus 1 only, acts trivially on the rest of the system. So this will be a local operator, and this identity that I've written, these identities that I've written are just to remind you that even though they act locally, they still act on the full G to the n dimensional Hilbert space. However, for notational simplicity, these will just be abbreviated by their non-trivial part. Okay. So this operator, hereafter we represent it just by this non-trivial part. Okay, so as I said before, locality really is an essential property, both conceptually and practically. As we'll see, for example, in the tutorial, when you assume local interactions, this often makes computation simulations more efficient. Okay. And this is largely because we're interested in properties of the ground state of these Hamiltonians. Okay, so we're interested in basically the ground state of the Hamiltonian, which is just the eigenstate of H with the lowest energy, the smallest eigenvalue. Okay. And this is because we're often interested in a system at low or zero temperature. Okay. We want to see how the system behaves at low temperature. Because usually at high temperature, it's actually hard to have non-trivial quantum phenomena. Okay, this is like a pretty active area of research, but typically things are most quantum at low temperature. At finer temperature, things become more classical. Okay, so again, there's a practical benefit to focusing on the ground state. So basically to compute the ground state of a local Hamiltonian, you'll see in the tutorial later today that you can actually use sparse matrix techniques, which allow you to go to slightly bigger systems than you otherwise would. So there's some practical benefit, but again, I think the most important is that conceptually, locality actually places a lot of constraints on the nature of the ground states. So ground states of local Hamiltonian have a lot more structure from a ground state of an arbitrary Hamiltonian, which would just be some generic state in Hilbert space. Okay. Okay, and so finally, the last aspect of a lattice model, I should just remind you about, I think many of you already know this, is that we'll be considering the thermodynamic limit. In fact, this will be essential in even defining, making the notion of a phase of matter well defined, the notion of phase transitions well defined. Okay, so thermodynamic limit, we want to take the number of sites n going to infinity. And again, one reason is because we're interested in universal properties of a system. And by universal properties, we really mean like long distance behavior in the system, long distance correlations. And to be precise in what we mean by long distance, obviously you need to take a very big system to begin with, right? And even more concretely, the notion of locality is pretty much only well defined when we take the thermodynamic limit, right? If I take a finite size system with finite n, right, how local is local, right? But if I'm taking this limit as n goes to infinity, then now there's a precise meaning, which I say if my interactions only involve, say, like order one, say two or three neighboring spins, that doesn't change as I'm taking this n to infinity, then this is a well-defined notion of locality. Okay. Okay, so yeah, so again, that's very, very basic stuff. Let me pause nevertheless for questions. Okay, good. So that's a setup. Okay, so now what do we do with what do we do given a Hamiltonian, given a ground state? So there will be several properties of interest. So one very convenient thing to begin with is just by looking is looking at the correlations in the ground state. Okay, so say I have some local operator O, and I just want to see what its value is in the ground state. And again, I will also want to probe long distance correlations in the ground state. So another quantity that we will want to look at is connected correlation functions. Of two operators that are far apart. So say they have support around sites I and j. And by connected, I mean we're subtracting off just the expectation value of each operator. Okay, so this is called a connected correlation function. And we'll be interested in how this correlation function behaves as we take these two sites more and more separated, right? So basically, this tells us are the correlations in this ground state long range or short range? This will be one of these universal properties of the phase that we want to probe. So these are like the most basic observables of the ground state. But as we'll see later in the course, there are actually phases of matter that cannot be simply distinguished using these type of observables. So for example, for some topological phases, first we might need to use some extended operators to probe their non-triviality. they might not be strictly local. They might be strings, for example. And in other topological phases, we might need to use more powerful probes like entanglement to distinguish them from trivial phases. Okay. But for many phases of interest, these are already good enough. Okay, so that's some observables, correlation functions. And the other property we'll be very interested in is entanglement. Okay. So now let me just briefly do a lightning overview of entanglement. Again, I think you've all probably seen this already, but let me just be complete here. So we want to know how entangled, how non-classical is this ground state psi naught, right? So, how quantum is psi naught? Okay. So this is a way to quantify the answer to this question. So entanglement can actually be very subtle. So let's just consider a Tor example of two qubits. Just to start out with, okay. So obviously there are simple classical states, right? So you might have a 0-0 state, which, just to be clear, means the tensor product of 0 on each side. Okay, and this is manifestly a product state with 0 entanglement, right? So this is a classical state, no correlations, no entanglement at all. Okay. However, you might have a more non-trivial state, 0, 0, +1, 1, right? And so now this is an example of a Bell pair, which you may have seen in your quantum mechanics courses. And this is a non-trivial state in which you have correlations between the two qubits that cannot be reproduced by any local classical model. Okay, so a Bell pair is entangled. Okay, and indeed, you can see explicitly that there's some superposition of classical states. Okay. However, naively, you might think, okay, if superposition is all I need, to get non-trivial quantum correlations, why don't I just keep on adding more states to make it more entangled, right? So you might try to add, the other two possible states in the Z basis to this Bell pair. Okay, does that make it more entangled? Maybe, right? However, as you probably know, you can just rewrite this whole thing as just a product state of the two qubits, not in the Z basis, but in the X basis, right? So here by plus, I mean just the eigenstate of the Pauli X operator with eigenvalue 1. Okay. So this state, which look complicated in the Z basis, is a big superposition, is actually just a simple product state between the two qubits. And again, it's a product state. Each qubit's doing its own thing. There's no entanglement, no correlations. Right? Yeah, so this is just to motivate the need for entanglement measures, right? Which can, they can relieve you from having to examine case by case. You need some entanglement measures which can quantify them that are independent of any choice of basis. Okay. So we need some measures of entanglement. Okay. Okay. So let's now define a measure of entanglement that's commonly used. So say I take a bipartite pure state, okay, and say we want to see how entangled the state is between A and B. Okay, basically, how far from a product state is this generic state psi B? Okay, so so as a starting point, we want some measure of entanglement which should be zero for a product state. Okay, and so it turns out to be very useful to look at the reduced density matrix. On the A subsystem. And so this is just defined by tracing out the B subsystem. Okay. And so basically the reduced density matrix is defined so that it reproduces all observables on the A system. Okay. So basically, by construction, rho A is enough information to reproduce any observable on A. Okay. Okay. So so for a product state. Say if I have phi A tensor phi B, then obviously rho A is just the state phi A, which is a pure state. So basically, for a product state, the A subsystem is in a definite pure state. There's no uncertainty about the state of the A system. Okay. Okay. However, if I have a non-product state, then rho A will be mixed. Okay. So it will not be some definite state like phi A. It will be some ensemble of different possible product states. Okay. So for example, again, let's go to our Bell pair. So for this Bell pair on two qubits, rho A is the maximally mixed state. Okay. So this is basically just saying, from the point of view of system A, it's equally likely to be in the zero or the one state. Yeah, and in fact, you can choose any orthonormal basis, and it's equally likely to be in both of those two orthonormal states. Okay. So the moral of the story is that here, for an entangled state, a subsystem looks uncertain. It's a mixed state. Okay. So we'll want to quantify this uncertainty of the subsystem. Okay, and for that purpose, what people usually use is what's called von Neumann entanglement entropy. Okay, and this is just pretty much the entropy of this mixed state rho A. Okay. So how much uncertainty is there for what pure state A is in, right? So again, you can check easily that for this Bell pair with the reduced density matrix this, the entropy is log 2. And for a two-qubit system, that's the most entanglement that one can have between two qubits. Okay, so this is just the definition of entanglement entropy. It's a good measure of bipartite entanglement in a pure state. And we'll want to use this to quantify entanglement in more complicated systems. So again, we're going to be interested in ground states of large lattice models. And we'll be interested in how entangled those ground states are. So say we have our ground state psi naught. And then we partition this ground state into a subsystem A and its complement B. We want to know how much entanglement is there between A and B. In particular, does the entanglement entropy scale with the size of A? If so, we would say this as volume law. Or does it scale with the size of the boundary of A? If so, we would say it has area law. And so for 1D, you can see that the boundary of A is just two points. So in one dimension, area law really means the entanglement between A and B is some constant that doesn't increase as you make A bigger and bigger. Okay. So this will be another target quantity we'll look at for ground states. How quantum are they in this precise sense? Yeah, any questions on entanglement? Okay, great. So the last important property we'll look at is the gap of the energy spectrum. Okay. So again, H is some, you know, 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, very, very large matrix. And we'll be interested in the spectrum of the eigenvalues of H, the energy spectrum. So there'll be a lot of states, exponentially many states. And then we're interested in particular in the ground state, the one with the lowest energy. And we will want to know if there's a gap between the ground state energy and the rest of the spectrum. Okay. So more specifically, we want to know whether, yeah, okay. So as you probably realize, for the finite system, you know, you diagonalize this Hamiltonian on your computer, and you have some set of states, you know, some set of eigenstates with eigenvalues. Usually there will be some finite gap. Okay. However, again, we're interested in the thermodynamic limit as you take a large number of sites, right? And so we want to know whether in that thermodynamic limit, does this gap remain constant as we take n to infinity? Or does it go to zero as we take n to infinity? Okay. So if it remains constant, then we'll call the system gapped. Otherwise, we'll say it's gapless. Okay. And just as a somewhat minor point, here I've drawn one ground state for the whole spectrum. As you'll see very shortly, there'll be examples where we can have multiple ground states, maybe like a order one number of ground states sitting below some continuum of states. Okay. So this you should take to be a caricature of some few number of states at the bottom of the spectrum. Okay. Okay, great. So that's pretty much the basic formalism behind lattice models, what we want to look at. So Now let's yeah, so now the goal will be to see all of this in a canonical example of quantum phase and transitions, the transistorializing model. Okay. So yeah, transistorializing model, as you'll see, you can see all of these properties, this phenomena there, and it's one of those things that keeps on giving. People are still finding new aspects of this model, even though it's so simple. So it's I think it's definitely worth covering this model in quite a bit of detail. Okay, so yeah, so for a while we will be studying this transistorializing model. And specifically in one dimension. Okay, so again, let's follow this whole prescription. What is the Hilbert space? So let's say we have a 1D system of qubits with periodic boundary conditions. And let's say we have a length L. So we have L qubits on a ring. Okay. And then, okay, that's the Hilbert space. The Hamiltonian is fairly simple. It consists of two pieces. Okay, so here I've decided to adopt some quantum information shorthand for Pauli matrices. Here, Z represents Pauli Z, X represents Pauli X. Okay, so the Hamiltonian consists of two pieces with two parameters, J and G. So this piece here is just a magnetic field acting on each qubit. So this is what gives the model its name. It's a transverse field. Okay, and this piece here is a ferromagnetic interaction between two neighboring qubits. Okay, so J and G parameterize the strength of each of these terms. And so, as you can see, these two operators, in general, don't commute, and so they will compete to dictate the fate of the ground state. Okay. With competition, things can get interesting. Okay, so yeah, okay, so that's the Hamiltonian we'll be working with. So, when given a Hamiltonian and a Hilbert space, it's often the first step in tackling a lattice model is to just first identify the symmetries of the problem. Okay. Symmetry is very important. And in this case, the symmetries are very manifest. One of them is just translation symmetry. Right, this Hamiltonian is invariant if I shift lattice one step to the right. And another important symmetry, again, giving the other part of the name of this model, is globalizing symmetry. Okay, so more precisely, I can define an operator that's just the product of all the x operators, okay, and you can check that this commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay. Physically, this is just a spin flip symmetry. Both pieces of the Hamiltonian don't care about whether it's spin up or spin down. Okay. Okay, so that's the symmetries of the Hamiltonian. Often the next step for analyzing Hamiltonian is to look at extreme limits of Hamiltonian. Okay, one can just get a lot of intuition for what will happen for the general phase diagram just from extreme limits. So let's start out with the somewhat simpler limit of a large transverse field. Okay. So when we take the limit in which j is zero, if we just had the transverse field, that's a very simple Hamiltonian. That's just a field acting on every site, right? And so when j equals zero, the ground state is just a product state of all the spins pointing in the plus direction, right? Okay, so everything is just pointing in the positive x direction. Okay, and this is a very trivial product state. It's called a paramagnet, because the state doesn't break the globalizing symmetry. It's invariant under the operator P. Yeah, so this is a very trivial state. All correlations are trivial. There's no entanglement. And the other, the other quantity we're interested in is the gap at this point, right? So the energy gap, delta, when j equals zero, is just 2g, right? And this is because the first excited state on top of this product state corresponds to flipping a single spin, right? So if I look at some state defined by taking this ground state and then flipping a spin at I, then this has energy 2g. Okay. Just to be clear here, psi naught again is a product state in the x basis, right? And so the action of z on the plus state is to flip it to the minus state, right? And this costs this will flip this will flip the energy of that spin from minus g to plus g. So it costs energy 2g. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So these are the first excited states. And there are L of them. Okay, just one for every site.
Professor?
Yeah.
You talk about the energy gap per spin, right?
I'm talking about the energy gap of the whole Hamiltonian, right? So yeah, so this is a good point. So for the entire Hamiltonian, the ground state energy will scale extensively to the size of the system. And so will each excited energy too. Those will all be extensive. However, the difference between ground and excited energy, they don't have to be extensive, right? So in this case, it's just some order one number, right? Okay, so that's the extreme limit for large g. And what about the other extreme limit? So for large j, or once again, the extreme set g to zero, then now I just have this this ferromagnetic interaction, no transverse field. And so one can easily check that there are two ground states. Right. There's a product state of everything being zero, or product state of everything being one. Okay. Those both minimize the ZZ interaction. It just wants everything to be polarized. Okay, so often it's convenient to choose a basis that preserves the symmetries of the Hamiltonian, right? So recall that one symmetry of the Hamiltonian is a global Ising symmetry, this P operator, right? So often it's convenient to demand that all the ground states preserve this global symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So for that purpose, we may want to take a different basis for this degeneracy. So again, this ground state, there are two ground states, they have the same energy, and we're allowed to take a different basis, one that will preserve the global Ising symmetry. So we can choose a different basis that's just linear combinations of these. So one of them is just a superposition of them. And the other one is just taking the superposition, but with the different phase. Okay. So this is another way of representing the two ground states. And yeah, again, one advantage is that these are eigenstates of that global symmetry P, right? So P GZ plus minus equals plus minus GZ. Okay. And so now we can see that already there's something non-trivial going on in the large J regime. One can look at connected correlations. Off the GHZ state, so we can look at ZI, ZJ minus their individual expectation value. And we can see that this is one. We can see that this is one independent of how far I and J are. Okay. So these GHZ states have this this long-range correlation. So there's something non-trivial in this regime. And it's also easy to check that if you look at the entanglement across the partition of the GHZ state, it actually has one bit of entanglement. Okay, so there's some entanglement, not much, but a little bit. Okay, so that's correlations, that's entanglement. And then now, what about the energy gap? So regarding the energy gap, so now we can try to find the first excited state in this limit. We can try to perturb this GHZ state and try to find the minimum energy excitation, right? So you can check that if you just flip one spin in the GHZ state. Let's say you flip the second spin in the GHZ state, then you might get 0, 1 plus its completely flipped counterpart. Okay, and this costs energy 4J, right? Because the two ZZs that gave you energy minus 2J are now opposite. They're now plus 2j each. So the energy gap between GHZ ground state and this excited state is 4j. Okay. But this is not the only excited state, right? So you can see that the energy cost for these excitations just came from the anti-align portions, right? So you can construct other ones by flipping even more spins, like a whole string of spins here. So now I might flip this third one, this fourth one, etc. And then I, you know, superpose the flipped counterpart. Okay, so now I can flip like a whole string of spins within the sea of zeros. So this is called a domain. And I haven't incurred any additional energy costs, right? Because everything in the domain is still aligned. It's not paying any energy price. It's only these two boundaries. It's only these two boundaries, which are called domain walls, for which I pay the energy cost. It's still energy only 4j. Okay. So in this case, since the energy that I pay is independent of the size of the domain, it's sometimes convenient to think of each domain wall itself as an independent excitation. Okay. And you'll see why this notion of a domain wall as some you know, excitation that can propagate will make more sense later. Okay. So right. So the excitations in this, the excitations above the GHZ state are slightly more complicated. There are these domain wall excitations. But as you can see, we can still we'll be able to analyze them in depth later. Okay, so the last point I want to make is that so here I've split this degeneracy in this basis, which is symmetric under the Ising symmetry. However, this is more of a conceptual choice. So the practical way to split the degeneracy would be still to split it in the more classically intuitive product state. And this is because these GHZ states are very unstable from several points of view. Okay, so if I take this GHZ state and I even measure a single qubit in the Z basis, I get 0 or 1, then the GHZ state immediately collapses to one of these product states. Okay, so the GHZ states in practice are very fragile objects that, in everyday occurrence are hard to find. Some of you, all of you probably heard of this Schrodinger cat experiment. These GHZ states are sometimes called Schrodinger cat states, precisely because they're these superpositions of macroscopic states that are very fragile. This is why we don't see a superposed cat, in our daily lives, right? So the point is that this GHZ basis is more of a conceptual choice that you'll see is helpful in defining a phase of matter in certain respects. But in practice, we often choose these two product states, which are symmetry broken states. Okay, so this is why this large J regime is often called the spontaneous symmetry broken phase. It's because the robust states in this phase, the product states, zeros and ones, have broken the global Ising symmetry. The global Ising symmetry doesn't leave them invariant. It just takes them from one state to the other. Okay. So this is sometimes called a symmetry broken phase. Okay, so yeah, in the next lecture, we'll continue going through transalizing in quite a bit of detail. And my plan beyond that is to, again, go back to the idea of quantum phases of matter and show you how these different properties, gap, entanglement, correlations, are all actually very closely related to each other. They're not completely independent for ground states of local Hamiltonians. So we'll hopefully be able to see all that for this model. Okay. Yeah, maybe I can just pause for any questions. Yeah.
So do we typically say that the ground state of the transverse serializing model, because those are the robust ones, that they have no entanglement?
These are the robust ones. They have no entanglement. They're product states. That's right. And they break the symmetry.
Right. So when we say ground state of the transverse serializing model, we're usually referring to those.
So for j equals for g equals zero, these are strictly degenerate. So it doesn't matter which basis for the degeneracy you use. In the next lecture, we'll see what. Okay, in the next lecture, you can guess what happens when g is finite. Okay, that will provide a choice. But still, I think it really depends on. I like to think of it as like a practical versus conceptual way of thinking about this, right? Yeah, and I'll go back to this point in more detail. Yeah.
Also, is it always the case that in this case you were able to construct a linear combination that respected the global symmetry?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you're always able to do that. Okay. If the Hamiltonian commutes with the symmetry, there's always some basis in which because when they commute, they can be both simultaneously diagonalized. Right? Yeah. So I guess the non-trivial thing here is that it says in order to preserve the symmetry, you necessarily need this type of long-range correlation. That's what makes it non-trivial. That's one way of looking at it. Yeah. Whereas the paramagnetic side, that preserves the symmetry, but it's also a trivial state. Yeah. Yes?
So in the gapless system, when the symmetry breaks down, we have gold stones, which kind of reminds of this broken symmetry. In the gap system, there can't be gold stones, but is there anything that reminds of this broken symmetry?
Well, here this is a discrete symmetry, yes. First of all. So there are no gapless gold stone modes. But for a continuous symmetry, you can have gapless gold stone modes of higher dimension. And But I guess it's okay. I guess I need to think more clearly about this. But here, I think it's still true that the non-trivial ground states, you know, the fact that they have this GHZ long-range correlation, should still be related to the character of the excitations above it, right? So you see that these domain wall excitations are also quite non-trivial, right? To create a single domain wall, you need to flip a bunch of spins. It's not possible to create one of them like locally, right? You need to create them in pairs, right? And so, okay, I need to think more about if this can be a bit more precise, but in that sense, the non-trivial ground state still dictates like the non-trivial character of the excitations, I think. Yeah, maybe this point will be clearer later, too. Yeah. Yeah, very good. So I guess I'll see you guys Thursday then.